Well, good morning and welcome, everyone.
Good morning.
It's great to see so many smiling faces out there. My name is Dan Proud. I'm the presider today. I'm not the minister. Our minister will be speaking, next week, is it?
Next week.
Reverend Sandy Ingham. Prairie aspires to be an open-minded and open-hearted community. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, regardless of sexual orientation, color, gender, or family structure. No matter what your age or abilities or inabilities, so welcome. I'm going to start out with some announcements. First of all, to call your attention to the announcements in your bulletin. We have one other announcement that isn't in there about musicians, and I'm not sure which musicians these are. Accompanists, is that?
Anyway, we need musicians for playing prelude and offertory. We appreciate anybody who plays. We have an uncritical, appreciative audience. Please talk to me if you're willing to play.
Okay, that's Mary Franz. And I believe you don't have to play a piano. It could be other instruments, any almost anything. So it's your chance. And also children are welcome to do that. And we have one other announcement.
Thank you. Ari is planning a field trip for next week for the lower two classes. We're going to go to the Southern Madison Food Bank. We're still looking for a driver or two. If you're interested in going with us, we'll be gone from about 10 until 11:15. And if you would like to bring a can or two of perishable food items for the children to take, that would be great as well. Thanks.
Thank you. Now we'll have opening words by Robin Proud.
So this is a responsive reading. It's in here and it's also in the hymnal, if that's easier, number 661. The Heart Knoweth by Ralph Waldo Emerson. So I'll read the first part and you'll read the italicized. We have a great deal more kindness than is ever spoken.
The whole human family is saved with an element of love by a fine feather.
How many persons we meet in houses whom we scarcely speak to, whom yet we honor, and who honor us.
How many we see in the street, or sit with in church, whom though silently we warmly rejoice to be with.
Read the language of these wandering eye beams.
The heart knoweth.
So please turn to hymn number 93.
Thank you.
hear of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. And we'll be having now a special story for all ages. Do we need a chair up here? Oh. That will be read by Rose Smith.
Really? Maybe she should know about this story, about her. Madeline's Rescue. This is one of our favorite family stories. In an old house in Paris that was covered with vines, lived 12 little girls in two straight lines. They left the house at 9:30 in two straight lines in rain or shine. The smallest one was Madeline. She was not afraid of mice. She loved winter, snow, and ice. And to the tiger in the zoo, Madeline said, "Poo, poo." And nobody knew so well how to frighten Miss Clavel until the day she slipped and fell. Easy. Poor Madeline would now be dead if not for a dog that kept his head. And dragged her safe from a watery grave. From now on, I hope you will listen to me. And here is a cup of chamomile tea. Good night, little girls. I hope you sleep well. Good night, dear Miss Clavel. Miss Clavel turned out the light. After she left, there was a fight about where the dog would sleep that night. The new pupil was ever so helpful and clever. The dog loved biscuits, milk, and beef, and they named it Genevieve. She could sing and almost talk and enjoy the daily walk. Soon the snow began to fly. Inside, it was warm and dry. And 6 months passed quickly by. When the 1st of May came near, there was nervousness each year. For on that day, there arrived a collection of trustees for the annual inspection. The inspection was most thorough, much to everybody's sorrow. Tap, tap, whatever can that be? Tap, tap, come out and let me see. Dear me, it's a dog. Isn't there a rule that says dogs aren't allowed in school? Miss Clavel, get rid of it, please, said the president of the Board of Trustees. Yes, but the children love her so. said Miss Clavel. Please don't make her go. I dare say, said Lord Cuckoo Face. I mean, it's a perfect disgrace for young ladies to embrace this creature of uncertain race. Off with you, run, scat. Go away and don't come back. Madeline jumped on a chair. Lord Cuckoo Face, she cried, beware. Miss Genevieve, noblest dog in France, you shall have your vengeance. It's no use crying or talking. Let's get dressed and go out walking. The sooner we're ready, the sooner we'll leave, the sooner we'll find Miss Genevieve. They went looking high and low, and every place a dog might go, and every place they called her name, but no one answered to the same. Where could she be? The gendarme said, we don't believe we've seen a dog like Genevieve. Hours after they had started, they came back home brokenhearted. Oh, Genevieve, where can you be? Genevieve, please come back to me. In the middle of the night, Miss Clavel turned on the light and said, something is not right. An old street lamp shed its light on Miss Genevieve outside. She was petted, she was fed, and everybody went to bed. Good night, little girls. I hope you sleep well. Good night, dear Miss Clavel. Miss Clavel turned out the light, and again there was a fight as each little girl cried, Genevieve is mine tonight. For a second time that night, Miss Clavel turned on her light, and afraid of a disaster, she ran fast and even faster. If there's one more fight about Miss Genevieve, I'm sorry, but she'll have to leave. That was the end of the riot. Suddenly, all was quiet. For the third time that night, Miss Clavel turned on her light. And to her surprise, she found that there was enough hound to go all around. There they are. Everybody has a dog.
Now it's time for sharing our joys and concerns. If you have any joys or concerns, please raise your hand. And we'll use the mics.
Well, I don't know if it's a joy or what, but on Tuesday I shall turn 88. Yuck. So Galen and I will be the same age for a few months.
I have a health report again today. Cheryl Robinson had reported that she was going to have laparoscopic surgery. She had it on Friday. She is back home and it went well. I do have a card for you to sign. And she said I could tell people that they found a mass on the outside of the uterus. She had been already tested and had what the number one, the first, the lowest level of cancer they had found before through testing. So they're hoping that this takes care of all of it. And so she sends her greetings. And the card will be on the table.
Some of you know that we got a new house back in July, and I have been working on finishing the basement, and I am happy to say as of last Sunday, the movie theater is complete, and we were able to watch our first movie in it, and it is great.
This actually happened last week when I got home from visiting my son in New York over Christmas. I had been there, and he had recorded a song I wrote, and I could not make the upper notes, which was very disappointing. Nothing came out but a sort of squawk. It wasn't even sort of that note. And as soon as I got home, I connected with a man I had gone to for acupuncture a long time back. So a lot of doctor things going on, but I wanted to see if this could help. And I couldn't believe after the appointment, I could sing that song. I'd go up to the top. I was so excited.
A health update on Lori Bond. She recently had some tricky surgery to shave back a bone in the ear that was interfering with a lot of things, and it went very well, and now she's able to use her left hand and walk better and use her left arm and something else I can't remember. And she's looking forward, she's always looking forward to the future. She hopes to move into a better situation in the Capital Center this year sometime.
I'll light this last candle for any joys or concerns that have been left unsaid. And now I'll have a minute of self-meditation. Well, we have a member of our congregation is no stranger to the podium and happens to be my wife. I don't know what I have to say. Let's see, maybe something about her that you don't know. well, one thing that she, Robin Proud, is passionate about is reading, and so I think she has something to say about that. And please welcome Robin Proud.
Good morning.
Good morning.
With everything I was doing, I didn't put on my name tag, but here at Prairie, we have items on our name tags that indicate something about us. My husband's got music. I see Marilyn there with the dogs. We've got people that have canoes and gardens and all kinds of things, and mine has books. So it's a little different for me to be up here. Usually, I'm bringing you some of my series on the famous women we've never heard of, but this time, there's something else that I really wanted to share, and this will be interactive, that you'll get a chance to share something at the end. I don't remember learning how to read. Apparently my brother, who was 2 years older, came home from school and he shared with me the immortal prose, "Look, Jane, see spot run." And I somehow picked that up. I was about four. We lived on a farm in a remote area of Pennsylvania, and the nearest library was in a town about 15 miles away. It wasn't very big, and there was no such thing at that time as interlibrary loan. So I think that the children's section was just a few bookshelves sort of the size of the one back there, which I have read through many times. We didn't have a lot of money for books, and it wasn't as easy to, there weren't a lot of places around to purchase books. I had some that belonged to my mother and even her father, which was wonderful. And I read some of those over and over, but now I've realized that a lot of times for children, even if they have many books at their disposal, they do enjoy reading the same ones again. So that was not a deprivation. However, when I was 10, we moved to the city of Philadelphia. That's a whole other story, but there, the main public library is a huge stone building, and the children's room alone was about six times as big as that whole small town library had been. I thought I was in heaven. I've always loved reading. Sometimes I've had to adapt. When I had two small children, a magazine article was about as long as I could get through without interruption. So when my kids got into school and I started working full-time in a business office, I thought it was terrific that I got to have a 15-minute break where I could just go and sit and read. I almost lost my love of reading once, and that was because I went to graduate school studying literature. It's sort of like the theory that if you catch your child smoking, you should force him to smoke a whole pack of cigarettes at once, kind of aversion therapy. Well, not only did we have to read 900-page tomes like Little Dorrit in a week, but then we had to take them apart and according to the prevailing trends, which were things like Freudianism, Marxism, structuralism. But I even bounced back from that eventually. So over the years, as I've been reading, I've also regularly heard the opinion that people who read a lot are eggheads, antisocial loners who can't cope with the real world and are trying to escape. But that wasn't my experience. I felt like I got more connected to the world through reading. For instance, some years ago I read a novel by Marge Piercy called The Longings of Women. Now, I don't think it's one of her best books, but I still remember that there's one character who was a middle-class woman named Mary, and through a series of events, she loses her husband and her home. The description of what she has to do to get through the day in the Boston area where she lives when she's not allowed to sit down, lie down, or wash in any public place really stuck with me and gave me a visceral experience of homelessness that I wouldn't have gotten from articles with statistics. In the same way, I think I paid more attention to the war in Afghanistan after I read The Kite Runner. Now, this might seem shallow, but it makes sense to me. Just as you might care more about looking at the news from a certain place if you have a friend or a cousin living there. Well, I had that sense, like, oh, I know someone from there. I think that journalists actually are understanding that power, and that's why what we see in long-form journalism is more of a narrative with continuing characters and story development. Well, many other people report similar experiences. Online, a woman shared about what she said was that books saved her from racism. She grew up in a white family in the South, and her family was very sure of how racial inequality was supposed to be. But she read To Kill a Mockingbird, and then later she read James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and other writers, and she saw that there were other views. But all this, of course, is just personal anecdotal evidence by a few people. So I was delighted to start seeing articles in the last couple of years about studies linking reading and empathy. In 2006, Keith Oatley and Raymond Marr from the University of Toronto published a study on this topic. And what they did, they assessed volunteers according to how much they read and if they read fiction or nonfiction. And they tested the participants on emotion, perception, and social cognition. So how do you do that? They had a couple of tests. One of them, they showed photos with just the eyes, and they asked the participants, what emotion is this person feeling? Is this person frightened or joyful or angry? They also showed video clips, and they asked about interactions of the people in the scenes. Oatley and Marr found that the more fiction people read, the better they were at perceiving emotions and interpreting social cues. But did this prove a causal link? It certainly makes sense that people who are already interested in emotions and relationships would read a lot of fiction, because that's often what it's about. So to test that, in 2009, the same two researchers took a new group of 252 adults. They measured the participants ahead of time for traits such as extroversion, agreeableness, and conscientiousness, and they assessed their social networks to see how connected they were to other people. They found a significant relation between the amount of fiction people read and their empathetic abilities. Also, they found that people who read mostly fiction, far from being loners or escapists, were actually less socially isolated than nonfiction readers. Their position was that reading fiction affects what is called theory of mind, the ability to recognize and take on the perspective of other people. Recent brain research has enabled researchers to see that there's an effect of reading. When someone reads, "He threw the ball," regions associated with arm movements are activated in the brain. When the sentence is, "He kicked the ball," regions associated with leg movements light up in the same way. So, and also reading about experiences or emotions of characters triggers those emotions in the brain. So it doesn't make sense. Certainly people who like to read romance feel that they get to fall in love again. And people who like to read thrillers get the adrenaline rush without having to be in danger. In 2013, two other researchers from the New School for Social Research in New York City recruited subjects for their experiment through Amazon.com. Participants ranged from 18 to 75 years old, and they were paid a small amount, $2 to $3, to read for a short period. It was under 30 minutes. Some read excerpts from literary fiction. For example, one of them was The Round House by Louise Erdrich, which is a terrific book, by the way. Others read popular fiction, such as romance or science fiction. And some read nonfiction articles, and they specifically chose them without human characters. So for instance, How the Potato Changed the World. After reading, they took the emotion perception test, which was the eye reading test. The researchers found that those who read the literary fiction scored better than those who read popular fiction or nonfiction or nothing at all. And this happened even when people said they didn't particularly enjoy reading the literary fiction. In popular fiction, the emphasis is on the plot, usually. So the motives and desires of the characters are told to the reader by the author. In literary fiction, the researcher said, the incompleteness of the characters turns your mind to trying to understand the minds of others. So these results imply that people can be primed for social skills. And when this came out, it was written in the New York Times. It said, well, if you're going on a date or to an interview, perhaps you should sit down and read some Jane Austen or Louise Erdrich or some other writer. But there's still many questions. How long does that effect last? And is an analysis of faces and videos which are visual even a good way to test overall empathy? Does this work for children? Well, for the last question, there was a study done. Dr. Marr from the original study in Toronto led a team that studied preschool children. They found that the more fictional stories preschoolers heard and the more fictional movies they saw, the better they did on tests of children's theory of mind. Now, the way they did that test is they'd have a puppet and say, oh, this puppet really loves broccoli. It likes broccoli better than cookies. Then as they're playing, they would ask which snack the puppet should have. And the fact that the child could understand that the puppet might like something different from what the child would pick shows that they were able to understand theory of mind. Well, the children who watch TV did not have the same results, possibly because TV shows tend to be simpler and prevent fewer opportunities to take on another point of view. Dr. Oatley has written, fiction is the original virtual reality. Fiction is about possible selves in possible worlds. It's a bit ironic that we're discovering the importance of fiction for children at a time when education reforms are emphasizing nonfiction. My understanding is that in some places, classes were urged to read practical materials like user manuals. Now, while we need to know those things, what could really be more practical than learning to understand and care about other people? So there was a lot of press in the last few years about this whole endeavor. An article from the Boston Globe from April 2012 states, "Research shows that fiction does mold us. The more deeply we are cast under a story's spell, the more potent its influence. In fact, fiction seems to be more effective at changing beliefs than nonfiction, which is designed to persuade through argument and evidence. Studies show that when we read nonfiction, we read with our shields up. But when we are absorbed in a story, we drop our intellectual guard. We are moved emotionally, and that seems to make us rubbery and easy to shape. Fiction enhances our ability to understand other people. It promotes a deep morality that cuts across religious and political creeds. So that was the writer from the Boston Globe. This isn't a totally new concept. Plato wanted to ban novels from his Republic because he thought they had too much influence over citizens. Jane Austen, 300 years ago, has a character say in Northanger Abbey, which is largely about books, only a novel, only some work in which the greatest powers of the mind are displayed, in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineation of its varieties, the liveliest effusions of wit and humor are conveyed to the world in the best chosen language. Stories can change our views. Studies show that when we watch a TV show or read a book that treats gay families positively, our own views are likely to move in that direction. Uncle Tom's Cabin famously stirred up anti-slavery sentiment. However, it could work both ways. When we talk about becoming rubbery, Gone with the Wind contains a justification for the Ku Klux Klan, and many people claim their philosophy comes from the novels of Ayn Rand. Now, that's one author I have not read, but my impression is that empathy is not one of her values. And why does empathy matter so much? So, and why am I talking about this at all? I have heard from some people who feel that when we have our book sharing Sundays, that that's not really an appropriate topic for a Sunday morning because it's really not spiritual. Now, some of us have different versions of what is spiritual to us, but what I want to specifically talk about is why this connects to what I believe. When we had a little panel here about what I believe, I called myself a humanist. And as such, I feel the highest value is empathy. The first UU principle, the worth and dignity of every individual, certainly stems from that. But I think that this undergirds all of our principles. When we talk about encouraging each other in spiritual growth, about compassion, about the right of the individuals, all of those exist within empathy. Even the seventh principle about the interdependent web of which we are a part is a larger field of empathy. And in my opinion, just about every evil stems from a lack of empathy. If we have empathy, we don't bully people, we don't blame them for their misfortunes, and we certainly don't torture them. I personally think that torture is about the greatest failure of empathy there is, even more than killing. And as such, it's one of the few things that I just can't read about in fiction. I have to sort of skip over sometimes. Some people have things where they can't read about an animal being hurt, for instance, or children in peril, and I just have a lot of trouble with deliberate cruelty. And we see it in other places. Last night, some of us went to see the movie Selma. Well, the differentiation between races can only happen when you make that person other than you and you are not able to put yourself in their place. As I was preparing this talk, I continued to see relevant information. A New York Times article on December 11th showed that gay political canvassers who had respectful face-to-face discussions with voters shifted the views of voters on gay marriage by about 20% in a lasting way and also often affected other people in that household. This didn't happen when the canvassers were straight people or when canvassers were talking about non-personal issues like recycling. Although Peter would say that's a spiritual issue as well. But what moved people was really someone telling his or her own story. That's why this was so effective, was that people were able to come around and say, this is our story and this is who we are. And that's what got people to shift their opinions. And just a couple Sundays ago, the Times had an essay called How Reading Transforms Us. It was co-authored by Dr. Keith Oatley, who was one of the leaders of the original study that I cited. And its focus was on how reading not only gets us to think about and understand other people better, but also to think about and understand ourselves. So that's a whole other area. Now we do have some caveats. These studies were done with relatively small samples, and even though the researchers controlled for personality traits, if the subjects were taken from university students, which is often the case, or even shoppers on Amazon, they may not have totally reflected the general population. And I also owe to Tom Lovett, who I don't think is here today, the acknowledgement that biography can certainly serve the same purpose. Biography is telling us a person's story with all its complications, or history well written, for instance, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, can also give us a chance to get into the world of another person, another time and place. We might have a simple view of Lincoln that we learned in school, and when we read her biography, there is so much more, and it's not all consistent, just like the rest of us. So it is not that only reading fiction is what causes this, but it has to do with the way that it's written. And none of this is to disparage or discourage the reading of quality nonfiction. We definitely need quality information. We need opinions and science. And after all, that's what I'm presenting today, is from the world of nonfiction. So I'll close this section with another anecdote of a reader's experience that was shared in an online book group. I'm quite addicted to the site Goodreads. I used to recommend it wholeheartedly. It has been acquired by Amazon a few years ago, so I'm not sure I recommend it quite as wholeheartedly, but I do enjoy a lot of things on there. I belong to one group where we are reading all the books of Dickens in the order they were written, and we're reading them kind of the way they came out, 40 or 50 pages at a time, so that it doesn't take over your whole life. However, this is an endeavor of many years. But the wonderful thing about this group is that we have people around the world doing this. We have a retired professor of English in England who will post something with a picture of the area that's in the book, and we have young people who have never read this before, and people who come from different backgrounds, so it's really been delightful, and I'll be giving a presentation on Dickens as a result of that sometime this year. And then in some other book groups online, I've just heard some wonderful stories. And this one was a man who was in his 50s or 60s, and he had a long career in engineering in both military and civilian life. He was very accomplished, highly intelligent. He read a lot of science, technology, and other nonfiction works, but he couldn't understand how anyone could waste their time reading silly, made-up stories. Then one day, he was in a summer cottage with nothing to read. His college-age daughter had left behind a copy of Emma by Jane Austen, so he started to read it. At first, it was challenging for him to get used to this different type of writing. But as he got into it, he was amazed at how absorbing it was and how much he cared about the characters and what happened to them. He had no idea that reading could engage the emotions. And he himself posted this, where he said when he got to the end, he was laughing, crying, and jumping around the room. He discovered he was a romantic at heart. He went on to read everything by Jane Austen and anyone like her. And I kind of envy him this discovery. It's a bit like The Wizard of Oz, where she goes from the black and white and all this color is there. And if a new book were suddenly discovered by Jane Austen today and I read it, I would love that, but I would have some idea how it was going to turn out. He really had no idea how this was going to turn out, so this was so exciting. Now, did this change his life in other ways? He didn't say that, but I have to think that being in touch with his emotions in this way through novels had to rub off on his ability to express himself with his family and friends. And just the fact that he shared this story online with great gusto, and he's proudly a regular reviewer now of historical romances, shows a whole new side of his character. So now, we're going to get to a very fun part of the program. I'd like to invite you to share with us a book that changed your life. It doesn't have to be fiction, although from what we've seen, I think that's more likely. But I'll give you a couple of brief examples. The summer before I went to college, I read War and Peace. I subsequently changed my course schedule in order to study Russian because I was so fascinated by this book. Now, this would be a better story if I had traveled to Russia or married a Russian or something like that, but none of that happened. Maybe another example, a little roundabout, is I read The Mists of Avalon around 1990, and that's a story about King Arthur told from the point of view of all the women in the book. I thought it was terrific, but what influenced me even more was there was an afterword where she mentioned that modern groups had reintroduced some of these pagan goddess traditions. That was totally new to me. I was intrigued, and researching that further actually led me to one of the first talks I gave at the Unitarian Church that I belonged to at that time. So you may have something that's even more striking about how a book engaged you. So we have a microphone to send around. We also have some clipboards where you could jot this down because it would be nice to share these for the future. So raise your hand if you have something to share, and Peter will bring around the microphone.
This is about a book, but it's not a book that changed my life especially, but I was in school taking education courses, and I'm an artist, so it was about art. And the book is called Children Are Artists. Not very big, about that thick, but very interesting. And one of the things that you said rang a bell, because little kids begin to draw first with a circle, with legs and arms being sticks. And they progress on to something further after experiencing something with their bodies. If they play catch, all at once they have hands. And that's very much like what you said about the brain being activated with these things.
A book that changed my life was The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. I don't even recall reading it. I don't recall the experience of it. But as an adult, I was wandering around on a literary tour of England, and I was walking through with this intergenerational group, walking through this area where there was a neglected garden there, and the little girl that was walking in our group, she yelled out, "Look, the secret garden." And as soon as she said it, it started to come back to me that had been such an important transformative book for me. And so I began reading it, collecting copies of it from the earliest one on, and writing about it. And I really believe that The Secret Garden, in all of its sense of transformation and healing, really was formative for me as a young girl and throughout my life.
My dad homeschooled me for a little while when I was younger, and we read To Kill a Mockingbird together when I was at an age that I wouldn't have been able to read it myself. And just awesome empathy training there. I remember crying a lot throughout it and just learning things that I would have had no concept of. And then a few years ago, well, about 7 years ago now, I read a book called Rule the Bone by Russell Banks. It's not a well-known book, but it's all about a little boy who has a very difficult family life and leaves. And the whole book is, he's just a very troubled child, but you gain such a sense of empathy for him and understand why he took the steps that he did. And his name was Chapman, and I named my son after him.
Oh.
When I was in high school, I read a book by Eric Fromm, who's a social psychologist, I guess. And the book was called Escape from Freedom. And it permanently changed the way I view ideologies. Essentially, the book says that there are many people who live in fear of various kinds and will be drawn or comforted by various ideologies that they can kind of give, they can outsource their thinking essentially to ideologies and then feel comfort from that. So that permanently is a lens that I look through, for better or worse. I mean, I'm sometimes critical of people where I don't think I should be. I mean, in retrospect, I put layers it imposes a requirement that I think things through myself, essentially. So that's my book.
Have you noticed when we sing the children after the story, we all come in the same key and we don't have a leader? Well, the book that changed my life was Darwin's Original Species. And he mentioned in there that he couldn't understand where the ability to make and appreciate music came from. And I decided to look for the answer to that. And 40 years later, it came to me that it's writing piggyback on voice recognition in terms of identification, friend or foe. Now, a corollary to that would be that primitive, illiterate people would be more likely to have absolute pitch than musicians, who have changed the standard A several times in my lifetime, so they've shot themselves in the foot. Well, speaking of libraries, I took this concept to a librarian, and she actually found an article where it had been shown that primitive people all had absolute pitch, and musicians, only about a third of them did. So that's something close to home. The reason I read The Origin of Species, some friend was telling me what an evil man Charles Darwin was. And my reaction was, how do you know if you read any of his stuff? And one of the reasons that I was so taken with it is that it's the only groundbreaking scientific treatise that was originally written for the general public.
All right, I have not one book, but many books. And they're the books that my mother read to us every night. We would have a family story time, and she read us chapters. And we were all sitting there listening, and she read us The Water Babies by Kingsley and The Wind in the Willows, which was wonderful, and the Winnie the Pooh books and Little House on the Prairie. And we all sat there and were just involved in this wonderful story. And the reason I cite all of these is because that's what engendered in me the love of story and the love of books. And even when I couldn't read myself, I was immersed in this other world that was fabulous. And that has stuck with me my entire life.
A book that I would say was very influential to me, but not in the way you might expect, was actually the Bible. Even though I had grown up not going to church, I had always had this idea that it's like, you know, the Bible was this, you know, holy book on a pedestal. And when I went to college and had this really amazing English professor, and I was willing to take anything that he taught, so he did The Bible as Literature. And I spent a semester where we took the Bible, and he said, it's a book. It was written by human beings, and it has inconsistencies. And he totally changed my whole sense of what it means to read and take things at face value and to not. He took that book off the pedestal for me. And what it did for me in my life as a whole is that it set me towards becoming a Unitarian Universalist. And so I would not be where I am in my life in a lot of ways without what he and that class did for me.
I grew up in a blue-collar family in the 50s with fairly typical attitudes about race. And when I was 13, I read a book called Man-Child in the Promised Land, which was a coming-of-age story, a painful coming-of-age story about a young black man. And it totally changed it opened my mind about a lot of things and committed me to not only to the civil rights movement, but about social justice movements all over the world. Changed my life.
I don't know about life-changing, but a book that had a big influence on me when I was young was The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which I read when I was 12 for the first time, which was the same age as Huckleberry Finn. And the passage that was significant was the famous one where Huck has to decide finally what he's going to do about Jim, turn him over to he's a runaway slave, turn him over to his owners or not. And he thinks about it, and he remembers all the good times that they had together on the river and so on and so forth, and finally he decides not to do it. All right then, I'll go to hell, he says, because that was the context in which he thought that decision affected. And I was blown away by that because I thought, wow, young person can make moral choices that have significance in their life, whoa. So that affected me greatly and remains my favorite book.
I don't think this book changed my life necessarily either, but it changed my perception of the world. It's called Enrique's Journey, and it was a Go Big Red book a couple years ago. And the reason it changed my perspective is it's about children from Central America going up through Mexico on the train to try to find their mother in the United States or their parents that has left and is working and sending money home. And I could just relate to how the bond is so strong between your mother and your family that you would do something that difficult. And when I was a young person, I actually liked Huckleberry Finn too, and it inspired me to run away from home. I was a very naive 12-year-old, but I had enough money to take my friend, and we got on the bus and took a train up the Mississippi, sort of, because I lived in La Crosse for a while, and I wanted her to see the Mississippi, and then we ended up in Rochester, Minnesota, and got apprehended one evening because our suitcase was standing out when we were 12 years old, walking down the street with a suitcase. Anyway, I got off track, but there's also a book called The Orphan Train. And then what really got to me was that there's a famous quote, which I can't share with you, but it came from school about, it's a poet, I believe, that writes about orphans and how we all relate to orphans. If anyone knows it, what I'm talking about, that'd be great.
A book I loved as a child was Peter Rabbit. And a lot of the Beatrice Potter books, and I think it gave me a special empathy for animals and a love and concern for them that stayed with me throughout my life. And also, when I was about 8, my dad gave me a copy of Heidi, and when I had the mumps. And I remember reading that, I reread that, I carried it with me, you know, when I would stay overnight with some friend. It was a wonderful book, and I liked very much the relationship that Heidi had with the grandfather and with the grandmother. She went to grandmother's house and read to her and so on. I think that also gave me, as a child, an empathy with older people, which I still have and still am.
I just have to pick up on that story you told about, because we read aloud Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, and so one night I heard some strange noises, went downstairs, and there were the boys in the kitchen taking cans and packing up to go on their own little voyage. So much for taking things seriously.
I was an avid reader as a kid, and I know I read thousands of books before I was 20, but there are only two that I remember. The Blind Bull and From Here to Eternity. And From Here to Eternity, you've all heard about. The Blind Bull, probably none of you have, but The Blind Bull. Was one that affected me the most. One was set in just before World War II in Pearl Harbor, and the other was right at the end of World War II, and a major who was badly wounded, and the question was whether he was going to survive or not. And he was reflecting on his life and the meaningness of his life, and what's the whole purpose of it. And that was sort of what the whole purpose of From Here to Eternity was too. What is the purpose of life? What are we doing here? How are we doing it? And the thing, one scene in The Blind Bull that I stuck with me, that it was his talking with some friend about what are we doing here. The friend said, well, we're all like a bunch of ants. We're in this big plane, and there's a mountain of good on one side, and there's a mountain of bad on the other side, and we can't see either one. And we're convinced we're headed for it, carrying our grain of sand, but we're all going different directions. And I thought that was a very good explanation of how we keep trying to do things.
Well, I never was a very good history student when I was growing up, and I think a lot of it had to do with the way it was taught, a lot of facts and all about men doing heroic things and dates and such. But I do like to read historical fiction. And so whatever I'm reading currently, that becomes my favorite book. So right now I'm reading Citizen's Creek, and it's a story, based on history about the African-American slaves that were the slaves of Indians. And so the story takes place in Alabama and Florida and Oklahoma, and about the history from the 1820s to like the early 1900s, and how the African-Americans were part of the Creek tribe, and then other African-Americans that were part of the Seminole tribe, and so on. So.
Well, you're next.
growing up, I got a lot of negative messages about what, especially girls, gender-based messages about what I couldn't do, feelings I couldn't have, clothes I couldn't wear, a long list of sports that I couldn't participate only because of my gender, and also being in the Catholic Church, that we were less worthy than men. I'm not saying that's well, anyway, we'll get into the discussion. But the form of Catholicism that I was raised in, the church that I attended, definitely gave that message. So I came across a book in the basement. I don't know where it came from, but it was about heroines. And it was for young adult literature, or older. And it was the first time I'd heard of Barbara Fritchie or Florence Nightingale or Clara Barton or, you know, the Ida, whoever, who rode out and saved all those sailors who crashed in the storm, you know, off the coast. And it was, you know, empowering. And I knew that it was a possibility in some ways. And so it changed my perception. And the interesting thing was that years later, I mentioned it to my older sister. She's 11 years older than me and had a quite different upbringing. We were quite separate in years and in circumstances, but we discovered that we had both been inspired by this book when we were children. And then we tried to find that book.
Okay, so I want to mention a couple of books. When I was a kid, we had the Mowgli stories, and you know, he's the Indian boy who is stolen away by a tiger or something and then grows up with wolves, has the wolf family, and I think it, well, I just was captivated by that whole story. I think my father had read me some Kipling stories, too, and I remember some of the pictures in the book. So I guess it gave me an idea that animals are people, too, in a way. They have individuality. They have their families and so on. And then ever after that, for years, I read, when I was an adult, I sought out and read books about wild children who had been raised by, well, there was an antelope boy, I think, in North Africa, and you know how he learned to do the tail signals, you know, to communicate, you know, like this, like this. And you know, they seem to be able to live, you know, in climates that we would require to have very heavy clothes. They could live naked and be fine. You know, so it told me the value of the mind in adapting to a climate, even, you know, or weather. And there was a guy called, I think, Caspar Hauser, raised in Germany or something. Anyway, when he was discovered, he could just reach into, I think it was him or one of these other wild children, he could reach into a pan of boiling potatoes and just grab out that potato, and it didn't burn him. So, you know, maybe the power of the human mind. And I just have to mention The Enchanted Barn, which was about a young girl who, she must have been an orphan or something, or her family was orphaned, and she heard about this barn that was vacant, and they got it somehow and made it into a home. And I've always that was on my bucket list. I don't think I'll ever do that, but it made me think I could.
Well, I'd like to talk about major readers I've known in my life. First, my father, who read a book a day, he told me, you can make $1 million, Rick, as long as you put a swastika on the cover and make it red and black on the cover. So, but he read lots of good books, too. And my sister, Kate, who is the most dynamic reader I've ever known. She just reads and reads and reads. She must have read 8 hours a day for her life. Reminded me sort of Erica Skoge and others that would never be found without a book in their hand for years and years. And anyway, that's just what I want to say.
This just on a light note. When I read Jeremy Fisher by Beatrix Potter, I was so enthralled and so envious because he did not have to wear galoshes, and I did.
All right, maybe just, just one more, a couple more, okay.
Oh.
Well, since we're on the subject of children's book, my favorite as a kid was The Adventures of Uncle Wiggily. And I just sympathized with the characters, and they made me feel warm and cuddly, and that just helped me feel good with the world.
Now you know why when program assistants get assigned to Robin, they wear track shoes.
All right, I think we'll move ahead. Thank you, everybody. And if you didn't get a chance to write down your book, feel free to do that. We'll have this available. Now we'll have our offertory. Let's see, maybe the next one.
Now is the time for us to welcome guests and visitors. If you're here for the first time or the second time, we'd like to have you introduce yourself and say what brought you here, or if you've been away for a while. Okay. Oh, and I don't know if we had sufficient opportunity to thank Robin for her presentation. All right, we'll now proceed with hymn number 320. Please rise if you're able.
Take the knife to heal.
A wonderful book that I haven't mentioned is a book of quotations by women that my husband gave me many years ago, and I use all the time when I do my talks here. This is from Virginia Woolf. When the day of judgment dawns, and the great conquerors and lawyers and statesmen come to receive their rewards, their crowns, their laurels, their names carved indelibly upon imperishable marble, the Almighty will turn to Peter and will say, not without a certain envy, when he sees us coming with our books under our arms, look, these need no reward. We have nothing to give them here. They have loved reading.
So please greet your neighbor and stay afterwards for coffee. And I believe we have some baked goods to buy. Thank you for coming.